So let's start by asking you about your own impressions of you've been through the thick of the COVID pandemic in Tamil Nadu. What is your what are your broad observations last year and a half? It's a very unusual period.
Yes, Satya.
Kind of
as you know, this virus is completely new to mankind. And Tamil Nadu was no exception from others, in the sense that they took it very lightly in the beginning. See, there were so many excuses, like most other obscurantists were giving, that poor people are, in any case, resistant to several viral diseases, so this will be one of them. And then many people are already immunized with BCG, that will protect them. So many, and it did not affect Africa and Pakistan and Bangladesh at that time during the first wave. So it won't affect us. It's a sunny country, sun will burn all the viruses, etc. So all those unscientific beliefs were also operating in Chennai. This sort of superstitions, rather, views not backed by science, were prevalent throughout several countries, and Tamil Nadu was no exception. So in the beginning they took lightly, but as the first wave was spreading, first they thought it will limit to Chennai and say densely populated places like Coimbatore, etc. But then they saw it spread even to less populated areas like Nilgiris, like Kodaikanal, etc. So people realize that this virus doesn't spare any unimmunized person at all. And fortunately, the death rate was less in the first wave. So in the beginning, there were some problems with hospitalization. But I would say that the previous government managed it reasonably well, in the sense they opened several new hospitals and COVID care centers, increased the number of testing, etc. Though I would have liked the testing to be much more, I think given the constraints, they did reasonably better, much better than many other states, except perhaps states like Kerala. The tests were more in number as well as in proportion in Tamil Nadu. That was admirable. And largely, they saw to it that there were no big complaints, because you must realize that Tamil Nadu was also facing an election. So they didn't want this pandemic to be one cause for their defeat in, or one cause to be debated in elections. So I think they went out of the way. They spent a lot of money. I don't even know how they managed to borrow so much of money. They spent a lot of money. And the first wave, the casualties were minimal, probably less than 0.5% or 1%. I don't recollect the number exactly now, but it's certainly less than 1%. Once the first wave was abating, you know, the government again got a bit lax, and they didn't frankly expect a second wave. They thought it's all over. It has once come and gone, and so many people would have got mildly infected. They wouldn't have shown at all. And so there will be some sort of herd immunity. So we have escaped. That was the prevailing thinking at that time. But then the second wave struck like a bolt from the blue. The numbers suddenly, within a short time, say 15, 20 days, it increased from say 400, 500 to 30,000 a day, etc. The second wave was characterized by three things. One, massive increase in the numbers in a short span of time. Two, the people who had developed severe illnesses were more. Third is oxygen requirement went up massively, most of the states were not prepared for this massive oxygen demand. And you know very well what happened in Delhi, elsewhere, especially in northern states like Uttar Pradesh and Bihar. In Tamil Nadu, the oxygen supply was a problem for, say, a week or so. But again, I would say that they managed reasonably well. I would not find fault much given the prevailing national circumstances and the oxygen production capacity in the country as a whole, etc. So they managed the second wave well, though the casualties were very high. As you know, the undercounting is in all states. No state is exception, or probably no country is an exception for undercounting, etc. So except for these few misgivings, I would say that Tamil Nadu handled it reasonably. And at the peak of the second wave, DMK took charge. May 7th. May 2nd was the election result. May 7th, they took charge. But they continued the treatment protocols, etc., without a break. And the new team rapidly took charge. Fortunately, they kept all the key doctors and the health administrators without any change for a sound reason. And I think that was a very good move. They didn't change administratively. So the administration continued. Most of the previous measures were continued. They added few more. And fortunately, oxygen supply stabilized. And the second wave also started waning. So now I think we are touching very low in numbers. I forget the numbers. I am not keeping touch with the numbers regularly because I am not going for any debates or discussions on this now. So, but I know that the numbers are very minuscule and the deaths are around 23-25 a day. Even these cases, about 400 cases or so, are localized mainly to dense cities like Chennai, Coimbatore. Other places are largely spared. And the vaccine was introduced on January 16 throughout the country. So initially, Tamil Nadu was one of the states where vaccine acceptance was much to be desired. It was very low. But very, very rapidly, it picked up. Probably due to massive propaganda by the new government, etc. It picked up very well. And now actually people are demanding vaccines now. You see, they have to issue tokens and people stand in long queues and all sorts of things. The problem is vaccine scarcity is there like all states because as a country, we are not producing enough vaccines. That's the basic thing. So whatever is produced is distributed on some pre-arranged numbers by a committee. So I won't complain much about those things, except that a large state which has a high casualty should be given more vaccines, but they have their own calculations. So anyway, I think by December, the government says they will vaccinate 80-90% people. But I would say 50-60 would be a very optimal number for us. 50-60, if they cover, I think as of today, I forget the number, it's about 15% or 20% totally throughout the country who have been vaccinated twice. Now, with the advent of newer vaccines, which may be in the pipeline very soon, and which may be in the field very soon, I think around 40-50% we will achieve by December. Meanwhile, the ICMR is predicting a third wave by October. So I don't know. I keep my fingers crossed. We really don't know. There may be third wave or there may not be third wave. There may be a third wave which is milder than the second wave. All sorts of things are being discussed. But I see little science behind most of these discussions. So most of them are look like to me like astrological predictions. But the point is that when you have a lot of people not protected by vaccine and not protected by antibodies due to infection, this virus is bound to be around here for some time. It may become endemic. In the sense, this low prevalence will keep on continuing for a year or so till it abates itself. You know, any pandemic has to abate itself. The last Spanish flu of 1911 abated itself after 2-3 years. So there was no vaccines then, and no drugs then. So any virus has its own lifespan. So I don't know whether, frankly, there will be third wave, fourth wave, fifth wave, because Japan has gone through the fifth wave. So I don't know what will happen in India. This virus is very difficult to predict. It behaves differently in different countries. Frankly, I did not expect Israel to get another wave. But Israel, which has vaccinated the maximum amount of percentage of population in the world, had a second wave.
What are the lessons learned from this? What do you, I mean, in the context of health, while a lot of focus has been put on COVID naturally because it's a new phenomenon, unexpected, not understood. But in terms of the balance between COVID and non-COVID cases, after all, India is a country with a huge disease burden, even without a pandemic. So the question is, how have we handled the non-COVID part of it? And are you seeing any consequences of how we have handled the whole overall situation?
So the predominant lesson that I learned personally is that if you observe the world, there are countries where the state takes charge of the health, and there are countries where people are left to fend for themselves. Privatized healthcare. And there are countries where a mixture of both exists. So though the virus spreads equally to every human being, it is the state-supported healthcare which is able to confront at least this virus in an organized way. So if you want to fight a pandemic, you must have a united force to fight it. Private enterprise, by its very nature, it is a dispersed system of economics. It is not a single unified force. So there are a lot of, divergent pulls here and there. So most of them were geared to tackle only ventilators and remdesivir and such things. But they had scant flu or scant resources about preventive aspects of the disease, or taking care of the mild cases at home, etc., and taking care of the poor, who are also super spreaders because they live in densely packed downtown. So the first and foremost lesson we learned was that you need a strong public health infrastructure, not for just this pandemic, but even those diseases which could not be tackled during this pandemic. For example, say elective diseases like diabetes or hypertension or deliveries or cataract surgeries. The private system could not take these diseases at all. It was the government sector which saw to it at least the emergencies ran well. Pediatric care, maternity care, cesarean, and some chronic diseases like cancer, which needed regular medicine, etc. The public sector took care, I won't say totally, but I think at least they made an earnest attempt wherever possible within the resources they had. Whereas the private system completely abdicated everything. Second, I saw was like everyone profits by a drought. Here, I would call COVID millionaires. Some people made huge money out of this COVID, especially the private enterprise. Huge, obscene, and unacceptable level of profit. swindling people in the name of all sorts of drugs and treatments and ICUs and ventilators, etc. This was also happening, but because it was a pandemic, the government could not control them, or because government also turned the other way around. Maybe both, a mixture of both also. But it's a fact that a certain section of private sector, I wouldn't say everyone, there were mission hospitals, there were doctors who are volunteering, etc. I wouldn't put them off.
Just some broad examples without taking names.
Huge corporate sectors, huge tertiary care centers all over the country. Suddenly, everyone became a COVID expert. Everyone had a COVID ward. And the charges were astronomical. The government tried to rein them in by fixing charges. They stipulated charges also for treatment. But many cases, it was more observed in breach. So we know that
What kind of charges are we talking about? Suppose you were admitted in a private hospital.
I just saw a recent bill from a private hospital. Somebody is needs an ambulance from point A to the nearest hospital, which is around 3 kilometers away. The ambulance charge was 15,000 rupees for 3 kilometers. So if you see the bill, four different doctors charge around, say, 4,500 rupees per visit. Four doctors don't visit at all. They do telephonic consultation. And so four doctors visiting, say, for 10 days, 20 days. Imagine the bill. And lab charges. So many unnecessary tests were done. You know, WHO prescribed only very few tests. In fact, WHO did not even prescribe CT scan. Whereas I know CT scans were taken in the morning, in the evening, and the night, etc. So, all sorts of malpractices, unaudited practices, unacceptable practices are happening in private sector. And they simply looted people, a section of them. I am not blaming everyone, a section of them. They made huge money. They became COVID millionaires. Look at this remdesivir demand. So in Tamil Nadu, people used to stand in the night in long queues to get one vial of remdesivir, whereas remdesivir was an absolutely useless drug. So ask ourselves, who is prescribing this? Some doctors are prescribing, and they are prescribing to so many patients that they are forced to stand in queue, hoping that their near and dear ones may be saved by this remdesivir. And the black market in remdesivir was humongous, I would say. Some 4,000 rupees worth of drugs sold at 50,000, etc. A vial. And we saw adulterated remdesivir also. So all sorts of illogical, non-prescribed treatments were happening. Steroids were pumped massively, sometimes more than, many times more than necessary. And I would guess that one of the main causes of this fungal disease, neuromycosis, which affected great majority of survivors of severe illnesses, is due to indiscriminate use of steroids. It was used where it was not indicated at all. So there was a state attempted medical practice according to established guidelines, and there was this totally unchained private sector, and a section of it plainly looting people unchecked. So these both things happen. So to come back, I think we need a massive infusion of money into public sector healthcare system, and it has to be strengthened, not just by numbers, it has to be strengthened scientifically, it has to be strengthened very professionally, it must be run very professionally, so that not just any epidemic, but several major diseases that affect our people can only be tackled by, say, a good public system. For example, geriatric care in old people, in poor people. There is nothing. mental health for poor people, there is nothing. Cancer chemotherapy to be delivered at home for poor people, nothing. If you can't do anything, at least palliative care for poor people, nothing. So all these things, no private sector is going to take it to the people. So only the government, tax-paid public sector, healthcare system, which can address all these serious gaps in healthcare.
Tamil Nadu, comparatively, compared to other states, has a better record in terms of the public health network. And as you mentioned, it probably did better than other states also. But what are the shortcomings that you see and what needs to be done to address them?
The basic principles are very, very simple. They have never changed for the past 1.5 years. Masking, distancing, and washing. If the problem is the states like Tamil Nadu is densely packed, but even there, if only this had been taken to the last village in a proper way, I don't think we would have avoided the wave, but it would have been a milder wave because many people would have escaped the illness or would have got milder illnesses. Viral load would have been less. But unfortunately, no state could take these basic measures up to the last person in the village. So again, to come back, you have to strengthen people's participation in major exercises like public health. And for that, every village must become a representative of the administration. Otherwise, whatever measures you take, it won't reach the last person in the last post in the village. So this is a major lesson for us, that public sector does not mean just government pumping in money senselessly and unscientifically and in a very bureaucratic way or politically decided way. I think the essence of public service is to ensure that scientifically guided medical care or health care reaches the last person, the last post in the last village. That must be our credo.
What has been the impact of the lockdowns? Was it useful at all, the lockdowns? And what is the, looking back at the over a year now, I mean, they have been imposed and withdrawn and imposed and withdrawn. How useful was it, overestimated the impact of the lockdown? Has it been used like almost like a blind formula in the absence of any other measures?
First of all, we did not know how to confront this disease at all. Second, we did not have the wherewithal to take on this huge challenge. But we only knew, even from the Spanish epidemic, that the one major way to control was lockdown. I know, to tell you a small interesting anecdote, even during Shakespeare's time, there was lockdown in London. You know, he could not play his dramas for 3 years. So lockdowns have been existing for 300, 400 years whenever there is an epidemic. So we reflexly announced a lockdown. And the lockdown announced by central government was totally cruel, I would say. It was cruel because you just lock trains and buses and any mode of transport, and the companies are closed, forgetting that millions of migrant workers are spread across the country and they wanted to go back and there was no way. I think all of us know that after the partition Holocaust, this is the only next thing I see, that lakhs walking across several streets, hungry, barefooted, tired, so that they sleep on the rail tracks and get killed, mauled by running trains. I think this is as bad as the migration that took place during partition. Only thing, there was no war, but this is a war against virus. So that was the major, I would say, unacceptable error done by the central government. There was no science behind that, suddenly announcing such a major law. But gradually, we all learned. Today, if you ask me whether lockdowns are useful or not, I would say limited, decentralized lockdowns, well-prepared lockdowns, whenever there is an increase in number, when they say test positivity rate increases more than 5-7, only in those areas, limited for 1 week, 2 weeks, and at the same time taking care of the people's needs, that lockdown is very effective. Wholesale, mindless, centralized, massive lockouts without looking after the other effects of lockdown is largely negative, and largely, actually, it's more injurious than the epidemic is. This is the lesson that we have learned from this epidemic. I wouldn't say, like, say, some fundamentalist that all lockdowns are bad. I will never say that. So, very, very decentralized, not even district-wise, even taluk-wise lockdowns, whenever there is necessary. So, it again boils down to power vested with people. It is the people and people's representative who must be enabled to decide for themselves on a sound scientific basis. The government's only role should be to provide them with all the data required to make a very rational and scientific decision, and select few people in the places where they can take such decisions and stand by them. That is why we need village panchayats, panchayat committees, etc.
So you're basically saying it should have been more calibrated, better informed, and with greater public participation.
Exactly. And decentralized, completely decentralized.
Now, how do you see this pandemic? It's not going to end. I know it's going to become probably endemic. As you're saying, the virus will become one more of many viruses that are out there. So in the coming days ahead, how do you see this playing out?
Again, Satya, it's very difficult as a doctor to predict what will happen. You see, if you look at this virus, any virus tends to mutate. We saw South African mutation and Delta variant, Delta plus variant. Another one, Mexican, is it? Or Brazilian variant. But of all the variants, three variants are completely gone now. It's only Delta all over the world. Why is this so? Nobody knows. Whether there will be further mutations, whether there will be total escape from the vaccine cover, nobody knows all these things. We all hope that it will wane in course of time, and there won't be Delta plus plus or Delta plus cube, etc. This is our only hope, but there is no guarantee that even the Delta virus should not mutate further. So putting all these together, how can one make a rational prediction?